Hello there. My name is Sagar Baroshi.
And I'm John Ingold.
This is the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope Podcast. So every week, we turn to a page from the Game Narrative Kaleidoscope book, and we interview one of the contributors about their chosen topic. This week, we have Eric Sturpey. Eric, welcome. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Welcome, welcome. We're very happy to have you. Our podcast is all about the craft of game writing, and we are very lucky to have you because you have seen it from all sorts of places and in all sorts of different companies, in all sorts of different locations, and you have given us a topic that is very fun to dive into. So can we start by just hearing a bit about you, your story, how you've made it into this wild and wonderful medium?
Yeah, sure thing. So I'm originally from the United States on the East Coast and moved out to California when I was 18, you know, kind of chasing visions of at the time working in animation was the big dream. I moved out originally to be a storyboard artist. And I kind of ultimately stumbled and found my way through the animation industry to discover that actually writing was kind of my kind of best spot to land. But unfortunately, at the time, the animation industry was an absolute mess. This was like 2011, 2012. And so after a couple of years of really kind of struggling to get anything going in LA, I decided to turn to my other great love, which had always been video games. And specifically, the reason I wanted to be a writer in the first place was the LucasArts adventure games. That was actually the first thing that made me say, like, because I played those with my dad when I was young, and he, you know, obviously could read faster than I could. And so he would be getting jokes faster than I could. And so he would laugh at things. And it kind of stuck in me at a really early age, like, oh, words can make people laugh. And that was like, a seismic little keystone that landed in me. And so, you know, even as I was kind of pursuing animation, video games was always sort of like the real like inspiration for where it all came from for me. And so in 2013, I was really struggling to find a job. And then I learned that Telltale Games, who I'd been following for the last couple of years, you know, because they had the licenses for Monkey Island, Sam and Max, you know, all these classics that had inspired me in the first place, they were hiring writers. And at the time, I had literally played all of Telltale's stuff except their current game, which was The Walking Dead. And so I interviewed with them and everything. And sent in an application, and I got turned down initially because they were only looking for game writers at the time. But the way I had applied was I had actually made a point-and-click adventure game and sent it to them, like, in a box to replicate the old LucasArts adventure. A complete try-hard gesture. And my samples were in the instruction manual, and then, like, the quick start guide was my resume, and so it was a whole thing. And so they turned me down for the writing position, but someone else in the cinematics group got a hold of this application and said, like, well, we're turning him down for writing, but this guy should be in the company somewhere. And so they found a job for me, because of my animation background, they found a job for me in what was called the setup department, which was kind of like, very basic. It was like the scripting, and I did some camera design. It was a lot of the stuff that kind of came in between cinematics and gameplay, and it kind of helped hook everything up. And so I took the job.
Setting up conversations, making sure that they work.
Exactly. And so, a lot of helping put puzzles together and things. And so I took the job and said, okay, 6 months, I'm going to really work on my resume, shadow all the writers, and try to apply again to the writing team. And, you know, and so it was like October 2013, I think. I finally kind of got my shot where there was a episode of The Walking Dead season 2 that they needed help getting the episode closed because there was some messy business about getting the episode made, and so they just needed someone to really rapidly get in there and just help finish the episode and kind of stitch together what they had. And so I kind of volunteered. I jumped in, and it went reasonably smoothly. And so after that, then I got moved over to the writing team full time, first with Tales from the Borderlands. And then, Minecraft story mode, and Minecraft story mode I worked on for out of the 13 episodes. On episode 5, I got promoted to be the lead writer of that, and then episode 8, I got promoted to be like a co-creative director, and so that was then like kind of the biggest chunk of what I did there. And then there's some Batman in there too. Anyway, long story short. 2018, my wife, who also worked at Telltale, she got a job down in Los Angeles. And I, at the time, had been thinking, like, it had been like 5-6 years there at this point. I kind of wanted to stretch my wings a little bit. So I was like, all right, I'll try going freelance for a little while. I'll move down to Los Angeles. And I got there, and like within a couple, like literally the week after we left was when the company collapsed. And we had no idea it was coming. And it was literally like the day we were packing up our moving truck to go, like our friends were our friends were all at a bar, like crying and trying to figure out what to do. It was the weirdest way to leave, and it was heartbreaking. And so like, you know, that context, then coming down to Los Angeles. So suddenly, you know, all these very talented writers from Telltale are flooding onto the job market. And I'm suddenly now what I thought was just going to be kind of like trying to like stretch my wings freelance. Suddenly I'm competing against all these people that like had been, you know, my friends and colleagues for years. And it was so emotionally conflicting and weird. I had an interview pretty early on where someone asked me they said, well, okay, you've been writing at Telltale for like, you know, 5.5 years, but do you have any real video game writing experience? And it was like, and it was this thing that, you know, there's a part of me that was like, how dare you? But then there was another part of me that was like, okay, actually, that's an interesting point. So I made it my goal. I was like, all right, I'm going to stop pursuing full-time jobs in LA, and I'm going to just be a freelancer and work on every type of genre. And I had a whiteboard in my office where I wrote down every genre I could think of game. And then I would just go seeking out companies that were making games like that. I got to work on a racing game. So I went and found a mobile company that was working on a racing game. Platformer, same thing, fighting game, like it. And so it's just like trying to find everything and just doing all these cold emails just to try and kind of like cross off my list, because I was like, I never want ever again someone to ask me like, what's your real video game writing experience? And it was a lot of work, but I was really fortunate that it went well. And, you know, and then in there, COVID started, you know, because this was like at this point, you know, 2018, 2019, then into 2020. And around the time that COVID was starting, I was like, okay, I want a more one stable job for a little while. And also, you know, with everyone going remote, suddenly a lot of these companies that were only contract were more interested in full time. And so I've been working with Epic on Fortnite for like off and on. Like they've been one of my more regular contracts. And they asked me if I'd be interested in joining up full time what they were calling like a story franchise team. So I was like 2020. I joined up with them full time. And I was working with them all through kind of like their really crazy period of like the super expansive growth during COVID. And, you know, that was a lot, kind of burned out a little bit on that. And then 2021, I got an email from someone at Remedy asking if I was interested in coming and helping on something there. And, you know, it was like, it seemed like an interesting time to go on an adventure. We had had a baby about a year ago. I was like, well, maybe we should give this a shot. And so then January 2022, found myself suddenly living in Helsinki, Finland. And here I am like 4.5 years later.
It's amazing. Well, it's pretty clear from listening to that firstly, that you have an enormous experience of games writing across all its various forms, and secondly, that you're a natural born storyteller. I think that's quite clear as well. But just to sort of, there's a million things to talk about, and obviously, everybody always wants to talk about the nitty gritty of Telltale's design. It's still like a canonical example of adventure games taken to an extreme, which mm-hmm. I think really resonates with what you wrote for the Kaleidoscope. But before we dig into that in any detail, we always ask people just to sort of outline the article that you wrote for the book for the people who haven't read it, so that we've got a rough frame to sort of talk around. Although I feel like we could probably talk around anything. So,
could
you outline what your article was about?
Well, so it's so funny. Like my article, so it was titled, I don't want to put my lips on that, an ode to point and click adventure game protagonist.
I don't want to put my lips on that. Yeah.
I think it was Full Throttle used it first, and then Curse of Monkey Island, I think, referenced it later. But it's in both of those, you know, you weren't using specifically talk to as your verb. You instead using your senses. It was hand, eye, and then mouth. And, which obviously implies talk to, but, you know, someone got cute and was like, oh, you know, you put the lips icon on something, and then, you know, and it would be Ben Throttle go, I don't want to put my lips on that.
I'm pretty sure that you put the lips on a rubber tube to suck some petrol from a car at one point.
Yep. Yes.
And use it as a siphon, which I remember just being stuck on forever.
There's always a siphon.
That's not what the lips are. That's not what it means. But anyway, yeah. Please carry on.
So it's so funny because, so the article is loosely about, like, yeah, the difference between what I would call the, like, adventure game era of video game protagonists compared to kind of the now. And it's also a little bit about just kind of my belief that sometimes game storytelling gets a little bit strangled by the kind of quest for immersion, and ultimately about how adventure game protagonists, one of the things I love about them is you are not fully immersed with that character. Like, you are very much your character's guide, and they are their own person that you're kind of guiding along. And so this kind of ode to the adventure game protagonist is just kind of going through why I love that and kind of the storytelling possibilities that you get there and why you ultimately kind of fall in love with those characters.
So one thing I really resonated with that article was the distinction between the player and the protagonist character. And I think the more writers that we talk to, the more I'm starting to see that they're almost two separate modes of storytelling, the one mm-hmm. where the player is the protagonist and the one where the player is sort of guiding the protagonist. So my first question with that has always got to be, how do we sell that to the player? Like, what do we need to do to sell to the player the idea that they're not in control of this character and yet they're in control of this character? Like,
yeah, the you
how
know,
do when, we do that?
Well, it's funny. Like, someone who I think the Death Stranding games are one of my favorite examples in like contemporary gaming of doing that, where it's like you have enough. Okay. Where like what I think is great is they use this very conscious, I feel like, cinematic tool of when Sam enters his little safe house, the camera's following him, and then it splits off, and then Sam is sitting on his bed, and the camera is here looking around, and Sam is very much not paying attention to you. He's kind of doing his own thing, and you kind of poke at him and interact with him. And so I feel like, yeah, you kind of need to use these. I feel like you kind of need to use these, like, I feel like the camera language, and this is my background as a camera designer talking, but it's like, I feel like the camera language does a lot to kind of psychologically tell the player how they should be feeling about their character, you know? And it's like, I think one of the things that's happened is, so many games now, have the camera framing from sort of the knees up with the player character on the left-hand side of the screen. You know, you look at like, Uncharted, Jedi Survivor, it is sort of what I'd call like the standard for like the third person 3D game. And I think what's interesting about that is it's like, I think that level of kind of intimate camera makes you feel like, oh, this is me. This is who I am playing as. And weirdly, it's like when you pull out just a little bit and you show the feet, I think strangely, when you can see the whole figure in the screen, you start to lose sense of that's me and more that's my avatar. Because you think about MMOs and things like that always had that pulled out language of the, you know, being able to still see the feet. Something like Legend of Zelda, still see the feet. And like, you know, I don't think people ever think of themselves as, like, no one ever is playing, you know, Breath of the Wild, and it's like, I am Link. They're like, no, Link is kind of my little puppet that I'm running around and kind of, you know, putting different clothes on and things. And yeah, I think there's a lot to that kind of like psychological feeling of like the separation there. And it's why, like, you look at Dark Souls, Demon Souls, a lot of those games, Elden Ring has, again, you are pulled out small like this. And I don't know why, but just there's something about that language that suddenly adds an othering factor. And I think maybe it's because when you do that, you're able to see a little bit more clearly the seams of the game, where it's like, you know, suddenly, because like obviously part of why, you know, you hide the, you know, hide the character from knees down is you don't have to do exact one-to-one locomotion. There are so many sins that you can hide below, you know, below the camera frame. And by kind of showing the whole character, you then kind of get to see the more doofusy things that happen, you know, by just puppeting a character on 3D space. So I don't know. That's my personal pet theory on the subject, but like I could, yeah.
I think that's really interesting. Yeah. It makes me think of Ico, where you have the camera really very distant and these people very small, but sorry, you had a question.
Not at all. I was just going to build on that, really, which is I've never heard it articulated this way. It seems very, yeah, very, very obvious in some ways, because absolutely this is kind of the trend that we've seen. I'm curious, though, about the choice that we have, because one thing I liked a lot about your article is you reminded us, you reminded the reader that, well, there is value sometimes to keeping a separation. Like there's something that you get with that, that you might not achieve in another context. I feel like we've been through like a decade of prestige storytelling in video games where it's always like, no, you must feel deeply immersed with this character. But it runs at cross currents with the fact that we, in that same decade, have wanted to have relatively lived-in characters that, outside of like pure full RPGs, are not just player stand-ins, right? Like you are inhabiting this person's mind, and that needs to be interesting for you to want to do, right? On the back of the box,
absolutely,
yeah. That is all. I guess that's almost never been true for classic point-and-clicks, right? Like there's something about the 2D, 3D flip that feels interesting to me. Like, although, yes, of course, we have many adventure games where you're moving in 3D, the canonical examples are very often you're moving, yeah, kind of in two dimensions, even if it's been built with 3D assets. Mm-hmm. Does that also contribute to this, to the separation a little bit? Like, they're literally in a different dimension, you know, they're operating than you are?
I think there's a lot of sense to that, where it's like, you know, you think about like the first, I'm sure maybe there were ones that were beforehand, but like the kind of first big 3D point and click game was Grim Fandango. And even that, you know, was still, you know, you were using these, you know, using the tank controls to kind of move around and everything. But yeah, but because you were operating in kind of these staged vignettes, like I think that again did something to sort of feel like
that
you were moving a character kind of around things. And yeah, I'm trying to think of like the first like 3D, fully 3D adventure game that I tried playing. Cause you had like the 3D Longest Journey.
I was going to say Longest Journey. Eric, it is unbelievable how you are anticipating. Like, I had a question for you all about tank controls, and now you've gotten there. And then as you were talking, I was like, first 3D game that I could think of this way is The Longest Journey, right?
That's so funny.
Yeah, exactly. But it's a classic. It's so good for this, yeah.
Yeah, well, and, you know, it's so funny what you were saying about, like, yeah, that how we've had, like, a decade or more now of the kind of prestige title of, like, immersing you in the character. And it's funny, it relates to, like, I have kind of this topic that I kind of think on a lot lately where, you know, it has to do with sort of the much bigger, headier topic of like media literacy kind of in culture in general right now, where, you know, we're having a problem with people conflating like a protagonist being shown on screen and their actions and sort of saying like, oh, and they're the protagonist, ergo, we are saying that we endorse these actions. And, you know, and it's part of like, you know, so many notes in any sort of storytelling medium now, a lot of the notes are like, oh, we need to make the character more likable. That's not a very relatable thing that this character has done. But then like you go back and you look at, you know, you look at movies from the 70s, 80s, and it's like you have some pretty awful protagonist. Like I was just watching the other night the Jack Nicholson movie As Good As It Gets, and he is a terrible person throughout the entire movie, and he like gets a little bit better, but he's still pretty bad the whole way through.
Classic example, Saturday Night Fever.
Absolutely.
Like the protagonist of Saturday Night Fever is an awful, awful person the whole way through, but not the point.
Well, and like one
the
of my
70s.
Other,
remember.
One of my other favorite examples is like De Niro in Midnight Run is a bad dude. Like he is a skip tracer bounty hunter who like, you know, he's an alcoholic, estranged from his wife and child. Yeah. And it's like, but it's the power.
Taxi Driver, De Niro's whole early career is full of these things.
He was amazing at playing these scumbags. But I think it's a great example of like the power of a movie star used to be like, oh, they have a charisma that overpowers the fact that they're bad people. You know, so it's like you see them and you're like, I know that they're driving the story and they're bad people, but like, I can't wait to see how they improve. And it was sort of this like implicit promise. It was like this implicit promise between viewer and creator where it was like, I am showing you a bad person, but you know, they're going to improve. And weirdly, we've lost touch with that where it's like, we kind of like, you know, that there's this like, so many like studio notes, like is that I do, you know, I do like when I still do work in sort of other mediums, so many studio notes will be things along the lines of like, well, we need to make sure this person's super likable right up front. And I think we run into that a lot with video game protagonists where there's this desire to really sand off the edges really soon, especially because you're playing as them. And so it's this feeling of like, well, we don't want you to, you know, we don't want you to feel disconnected from that character.
I think that's really, really interesting. Like, I mean, I guess there's that thing of when we're in a game and we always identify with the character to some extent. And so is it that when we're playing a game, if we were to play a game where we were a bad person, that people would start to feel that it was reflecting back on them? Is that what we're worried about? Like,
yeah, I mean, I guess
in a way that doesn't happen when I watch Taxi Driver, because I know I'm definitely not that guy. And that's why the film is watchable.
Well, I think it's this feeling of like, it's the person being like, well, I wouldn't do that. You know, that's not what I would do. Like one of the most visceral examples of this I can think of, is L.A. Noire, where it's I think the break from Act Two to Act Three, when you get demoted back to arson, you find out that you're cheating on your wife, or you know, your player character is cheating on his wife rather. And I remember at the time playing it, I felt so betrayed by that because I was
I lost the game, lost me then completely. Yeah,
it completely lost me. And so I completely fell off of the game at that point. And I think back on that a lot because like I still think about it all the time. So it was clearly a powerful storytelling choice, but it was just like, I think what it was it felt like because the game gave you so many choices of whether or not you were going to like go home to your wife, and I always made the choice to go home to my wife, and then the cheating happened anyway. But I think strangely, if you told me in the very beginning that my player character was cheating on his wife, I'd be like, well, that my player character is kind of a scumbag, but I guess this is who he is, and let's see if he improves over the course of the story. And yeah, so it's like, it's really interesting where it's like by making that choice late, it really lost me in a way.
It messed it up.
Yeah.
Yes. I love that you framed this as a media literacy question. And really almost like a medium literacy question. Like what is it that we want from a game versus what do we want from another medium? I also think it's particularly interesting that you reference the 70s, because it does strike me. I've been going into a lot of media from the 70s, and it feels like there was a tolerance for quite complex storytelling across a lot of different popular media, like in that decade in particular, where you start to see these like very like purpose. It's almost like the show or the movie or whatever is like fighting with the viewer, like is like intentionally not trying to be too clear.
I was watching being antagonistic.
I was watching this like old British show called Sapphire and Steel, where you have no idea kind of ever what is going on. Like the primary characters are literally like, well, they're not. Well, they're like pretend elements from the periodic table is the idea, but that evoke these emotions. And I think you've hit on it really well, which is it has to do with almost the timing of the revelation of like at what point do you want to have a twist that the audience can get excited about? But how can you have that twist if you haven't established that character ahead of time?
Because I feel like you and like you almost have like you almost have like a player, or you almost have like a contract with the media that you're engaging with, right? Where it's like you sort of sign up saying like I understand, like at a certain point you're like I get who this character is, and so it's like I think it's why like. In a lot of movies, for instance, you have maybe a first like 10, 15 minutes of introducing a lot of stuff about the character. And then you kind of just like hit cruise control for another like 15 minutes or so, where you kind of then just sort of see how that plays out. And so it's like that first half hour is almost like building your contract of like, this is who I understand this character to be. And I feel like you have now told me everything I need to know. And so I feel like when something like a late twist happens that feels completely unmotivated, I feel like that's something where it's like, this feels like something you should have told me about the character early on, or I don't know if I would have been on for this
whole time. The timing of the revelation. Unless you're playing into a trope that is known, at which point you're like, oh, I expect this like terrible detective gumshoe to be the one who, I don't know, is an alcoholic or something, because that's part of the trope. Like, I know that to be.
But that feels to me really interesting, because I think if we come to the conclusion that, okay, simply we cannot have a main character who is a scumbag who's cheating on his wife, it's just never going to fly, then that seems to be a fail state for like narrative in our medium. It must be possible to do it, right? So if we do it early, if we do it the way that you're suggesting, we start the game and we show that this is one of the aspects of this guy. He's kind of a Don Draper kind of guy. I don't know.
Yeah.
Like there's another character who we love to support, even though we know he does a load of stuff that he shouldn't. I feel like we would then have to be presenting the player with these moments of, do you go home to your wife or do you go home to your mistress? And giving the player a reason to weigh that choice, which isn't what's the right thing to do here. Because, of course, for a player, the right choice is every single time going to be go home to the wife, unless we show them why this guy is doing what he's doing. And we dig that level deeper and we say, okay, it's not great, but the reason he's having an affair is not because he's an entitled sort of freak who wants to have everything, but because of something else that's going on. And I actually can't remember if L.A. Noire ever justified the reason that he was having an affair beyond this is what happens in this kind of story.
Only in the way that he was like truly in love with this mistress. Like he was forced into like the 1950s life.
Right.
But the so real life was like cabaret life for him, sort of. Like
that's really interesting. Can we sell that to a player? Can we give a player the choice between go home to your wife because you should and go back to the woman that you love because you actually love her, which is, of course, the thing the player doesn't feel, but the protagonist does. Because that sounds to me like a really worthwhile thing to try and solve, but I'm not actually sure exactly how you would go about solving it.
It's like, I think... With something like that, like you kind of need to be aware that this is something that character is wrestling with, and it's funny because I my wife is an amazing narrative designer, and I was just I was actually just talking with her about this the other night where this idea that sometimes in order to I've been kind of working on this idea that. If you kind of weight it so that like the morally quote unquote wrong choice seems more favorable, like mechanically for some reason, then it can, because like players, like in like, I feel like throughout every single, so many instances, players always want to play morally correct. Like, I think it's baked in this notion of like, I want other characters to like me because that will give me more content with those characters. And like, and that's a better value. Like, I think on some level, players are thinking in that, in those terms, but also just people want to be good, I think is the other factor. Yeah. And like, and so I think it's really interesting then if you present the quote unquote bad option as seeming like the one that's more compelling for whatever reason, then either players will be tempted and choose it. And it's like, oh, I'm giving into temptation. Or they'll say, I'm still making the right choice and now I feel good about it and justified. Mm. And so, yeah, I feel like if L.A. Noire had been presenting this notion of there's the mistress and there's the wife and like, you know, being with the mistress is giving some sort of other benefit. It kind of, you know, like either to the mystery or just because it seems like she's offering something that the wife isn't. Because, yeah, it's like just presenting it as like a storytelling beat that happened. And, you know, where you kind of see it happening the whole, like they hint at it a couple of times where like he's going to the cabaret club and like they keep showing it. And it's just like, well, yeah, but he's not going to do that. He thinks this woman's beautiful or whatever. And then it's just like such a gut punch when you find out that not only is your character sleeping with her right now, but also like, oh, he's been doing it the whole time. And now I feel terrible.
Yeah.
Because I think I feel like if I was going to design for that plot thread, what I would want to do is to take that idea and then push it a little bit further. Because I think that's the right foundation. You have to say, if you're doing the wrong thing, then that's some kind of mechanical benefit. But there's a risk associated with it as well.
Yes.
Because if you're actually in the mindset of this guy, presumably the reason he does go home to his wife sometimes is so that she won't find out. Because if she finds out, that's a problem. And so if you can encourage the player to say, okay, I'm going to have to decide this evening, what can I get away with this evening? Can I do the bad thing or do I need to play the good card to kind of mitigate the cost of it? Which is taking the player to a reasonably dark space in that they're controlling this character and kind of working out how to be the bad guy as efficiently and effectively as possible. Which is interesting. Like there are some games where you play the bad guy. We've written a couple ourselves at Inkle, but it's a very hard sell for players not to sort of just be revolted, essentially, just to say, well, I don't want to solve this guy's problem.
Yeah. No, it's
that's interesting. But it sounds like a compelling thing to try. Sorry, I cut you off.
This is stuff I think about a lot because it's like, you know, how can you sort of get away with making these characters that are kind of more morally ambiguous? I'm working through a rewatch of Twin Peaks right now, and I think Dale Cooper is such a fascinating example of a character where you really don't, he is so inscrutable,
he's so weird.
Just through so much of that first season, I keep looking at him as this example of like you never really feel like you get to know him, and he's always sort of surprising you. But Kyle MacLachlan's performance is so strong and so consistent that it just works. And so he feels to me kind of weirdly like he would be a great example of like a video game protagonist that, like, you know, where you could pull off having these sorts of weird choices occasionally, where it's like, oh, you know, these strange choices and twists.
Sorry, that's a really interesting other way of solving the problem, isn't it, actually? If we have a protagonist whose main thing is not that he's, not necessarily that he sets up what his moral ambiguity is early on, but that he's consistently surprising us. Like, imagine a game where you have a main character who has a secret, and you find that secret out within 3 minutes, and then it turns out he's got another one, and another one, and another one. And then by the time you get to act three, and like it turns out he's having an affair with his wife, you'd be like, ah, there it is. You know, you could...
So
sort of sell that distance instead.
A hilarious example of this that actually is was kind of by accident is in The Dig. You're playing as a Commander Boston Lowe leading a team of and have you guys played The Dig?
Years ago.
So it is maybe my favorite of the like classic LucasArts era, because it was like the final like cinematic but still 16-bit LucasArts point and click adventure games. And I've been lucky enough to work with a lot of people that worked on it, and every single person says top to bottom was a complete mess, that the entire production, because it started from because the initial pitch was it was going to be Steven Spielberg writing a point and click adventure game for Lucas's, you know, the Lucas's computer game company. And that was how it was kind of announced to the world. And sure enough, they did a lot of writer's rooms where it was, you know, Spielberg trying to work, you know, and adapt this story into a point and click adventure game. And then he kind of moved on from it, and it kind of fell apart and everything. They just kept falling down these teams of people. Something like 8 or 9 dev teams over the course of like 10 years that this thing got made.
Wow.
And so what hilariously happens over the course of this is your character of Boston Lowe, he got rewritten, and his backstory got rewritten so many times that he's completely inconsistent through the whole, like, it works because the performance is so strong, but he'll have these moments where he reveals that, oh, he's on a secret mission that he didn't tell the others about, or oh, he has this backstory that he didn't know about, and it just kind of keeps emerging.
Of course,
emerging
you are, Boston, because you keep doing this. Yeah,
no, he'll see something, and he'll be like, ah, that's clearly this. And you're just like, how did you know that, Boston? Like, what do you know that you're not telling me? And yet it weirdly makes him, and it's hilariously similar to like the possibly apocryphal story of but of Humphrey Bogart in Casablanca, where they kept rewriting his character over the course of filming. And so it kind of gives him this incredibly nuanced and textured past, because it seems like he's always talking about this different stuff. But so like, I think there is something to, you know, what you're saying, John, of like, you could just go the other way and just make a character who his whole thing is surprising you.
This is a great discussion point. I guess I would put it to you both that choosing to have your character be surprising could work really well, but it doesn't strike me that that's the only potential option. Like, that seems to me like one path through here, that surprise. But that works for a certain type of protagonist and maybe a certain type of genre. I guess I would suggest that, like, much more typically, what we might have, like, we're basically setting up a prototypical scenario where we have a character where we want some big reveal to happen, and what we're all discussing is how much of the topic of that should be set up in that first 30 minutes equivalent for the game, right? Like, how much do you have to reveal for that to not lose the impact, but for you to feel like it's deserved, right? And I feel like we often have characters these days who have some sort of trauma at their heart, like some sort of something that has gone wrong or some sort of unresolved sin, especially in horror games, but not only. And that maybe is another way of doing it, that you know that they are ruminating over something, and that might cause them to sort of say something or react to something or reference like a previous event that hasn't happened. But you don't know the meat of it until you get to the right flashback, or you get to a certain point in the story that like forces them to finally like tease that apart or deal with it. So is that not a more typical way that we might do it? I feel like that feels like it exists in games quite a bit more. And the fix to L.A. Noire should be something like, you get a moment early on, not just with like Phelps like rising through his career, which is all you get of him as like this like straight-laced character, but rather this person who sort of is like torn between his heart and his duty, right? Which is a very universal story. I don't know. Yeah, what do you both think?
I think setting it up hinting at there being something more to discover. And it's funny, like, I'm kind of just in the LucasArts and LucasArts adjacent world right now, but like Raz from Psychonauts is an example of
Raz,
this that I love,
where
where they tell you pretty early on his family has a curse on them.
Yeah.
And that's kind of all you really know. And then you sort of learn like, oh, the reason Raz can't go in water is because he's been cursed to die on water. So he's got this like deep built-in phobia of it. And like, you kind of learn bits and pieces of that over time. And I think that's a great example where it's like, you can kind of keep pulling that back. And then there's great reveals about like, there's stuff about that curse that he doesn't know. And that's, that's obviously what all of Psychonauts 2 is about. But yeah, but like, none of that is ever betraying him as a character or your understanding of him as a character. You know, it's instead kind of getting this kind of extra stuff to it. And so it's like, I think going with the idea that like, you know, Phelps in L.A. Noire, if we're still kind of workshopping how to make that twist work of him sleeping with this woman, I think it would need to be either he had a history with her before, or like, you know, or there's someone else that he has cheated on, or like, I could even see a world where, you know, I could even see a world where that person is like his ex-wife or something like that. Like, just have some sort of connection there that makes it clear, like, oh, that's a thread that is still pulling him back again.
But it's interesting. I think if we, workshopping the L.A. Noire problem is a really interesting thing to have ended up doing, but that we can kind of separate what problem are we actually trying to solve here? Because you could imagine a version where Phelps is actually a perfectly likable guy, and we spend the game setting up that his relationship with his wife is just awful, and he's miserable, and she's just horrible. And like, we could see that very early. His colleagues could be all like, oh dear, rough night again, you know, you're looking really down, this isn't working. And then you realize when he finally reveals that he has this other way of like living his life and coping, you kind of think, well, yeah, okay, I'm not necessarily the choice I would make, but at least I understand why you're doing this. I understand, you know, foreground it properly.
And I
which
feel
is
like,
very different than the he's a dirtbag that we started off with, which is kind of what, when you land it as a twist, that's the only conclusion we can draw, right? Is that, geez, dude, you shouldn't be doing that.
Yeah, because like I think it again comes back to this idea that they have violated the contract with the player and their sort of understanding of who their character is. Because yeah, it's like, you know, I feel like what you're describing, like, oh, he's a perfectly nice guy, and then sort of the reveal that he's sleeping with someone else. I think that to me feels like in like TV show terms, that would be like the twist at like the end, at the end of the pilot or something like that,
or the penultimate episode or something. Yeah,
right.
Like if it was going across the season. Yeah.
Yeah. Then and it's like kind of choosing a moment like that still feels like it's within either the players, either like your contract of understanding that character, or like that it feels like there was some broadcasting there. Because I think I feel like the reason you and I are both describing this feeling of betrayal when that happened in L.A. Noir was because it really did feel like in many ways it just sort of came out of nowhere. I've always been fascinated to know, like, if there was a story there to like, did a plot line get cut that they just weren't able to do because they were so focused on the kind of climbing the career ladder stuff? Was it a late edition ad? But yeah,
my understanding of the production of that game was it was a disaster.
Difficult.
Yeah, yeah. So I imagine it was a victim of multiple cuts. Yeah.
Though I do think it's wonderful that three writers have come together for 35 minutes and our conclusion has been that you should foreshadow occasionally. It's good.
We'll go back and edit in a few hints that's the way to do it.
Right. We'll foreshadow this too. I do have a related comment, but that is like, if looking at adventure games specifically, mm-hmm. it's funny, as we've been talking, although a lot of what we've been talking about is this sort of prestige cinematic third-person 3D world type of game, right? Back in adventure games, and especially like classic style adventure games, I feel like that is handled actually pretty well. It is pretty common to like have this sense like this protagonist has a weird relationship with someone, and I don't know what that's all about. Say like April Ryan in The Longest Journey, and that gets resolved late, or the reveal comes and it feels well deserved, right? Like the sort of the person who's sleeping rough on like the street in front like turns out to be very important. Talk about like the Blackwell games, like you have a bunch of this like in and out that like clearly Dave Gilbert got to experiment with a lot over the course of that series. But even in more modern ones, like The Drifter or Thimbleweed Park.
The Drifter is what I was just thinking of. Or like Thimbleweed Park, yeah, everyone has a secret in that game.
Everyone, like kind of and that's also the genre. So you're sort of like, oh yeah, this is some weird cop with some sort of weird governmental secret. And you don't need to know the answer right away. Like you're like, okay, cool, I'll figure it out at some point. Because meanwhile, what else there is to do is always so full. That's the thing about adventure games. Like there's always some sort of driving motion. There's something you can do. There's something you can click on that you haven't clicked on.
Well, you know, I wonder if part of that is like, it feels like the classic adventure game format, or like, you know, even the more modern one, the inciting incident always happened before the game started.
Yeah. Someone died or something.
Because I think on some level there was this feeling of like, you know, like you talked to a lot of these classic point click adventure game developers, and they're like, well, yeah, we knew we couldn't make any of that playable or look good, so we just told you we had that in the opening credits animation, or like, you know, that's like in the instruction booklet that says why you're here. But like, yeah, you think back to any of like, yeah, that like, you know, you think back to so many of these classics, and it's like, you know, Thimbleweed Park, someone died before the game started. Just like, you know, they just like in Maniac Mansion or, you know, Day of the Tentacle, like, you know, the tentacle turned evil before the start of the game, and you're showing up there now to try and do something about it. And so, yeah, it's like, I think if you kind of trace that thread, it's like so often it feels like when you're playing a game and one of the first things you're doing is trying to gamify the sort of inciting incident, it's this feeling of like, yeah, you're sort of introducing what is the story while also who is the character. And like, it feels like a lot of table setting to then also say, oh, and by the way, your character has problems.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that might be why famously, I suppose, like in game narrative structures, we have an unusually small first act in the traditional sense of how acts are structured in the West, right? Like that, a very long like second act, right? Because that first act, like you need like a hint of what the world before is. If even that, it could have happened. The change could have already occurred, and you just need to sort of see them straight into the action, because we just don't have patience as players to like sort of sit there in that universe.
Yeah, the player has always got to be doing something, right?
Yeah.
I think one could imagine a game where the protagonist is well enough defined that before the inciting incident happens, the thing that they're doing is, you know, one of the mechanics of the game, and they're doing it. So I know you're a delivery driver and you're doing deliveries, and you do three of them, and then the third one there's a dead body in the house and you go, holy shit, the plot has started.
This is the thing we used to talk about at Telltale a lot, like just kind of defining what made for a good Telltale protagonist. And you know, and like to kind of, in my opinion, two of the greatest Telltale protagonists were Big B Wolf in Wolf Among Us, and then Batman where it's like, you know, because you know who those characters are right off the bat, you know what their sort of moral conflict is. You know, Big B Wolf, he's the big bad wolf in human form. And so he's like trying not to be a big bad wolf, but he really wants to. Great conflict.
Yeah, you're done. You know, yeah.
Batman needs to solve crimes, but he's also trying to maintain his life as Bruce Wayne. Like, you know, then it's like, you know, that moral conflict is baked right in there. And yeah, and so it's like, I feel like, you know, like you said, the player always wants to be doing something. So you got to just get them to it as fast as possible. And especially if you're in like this immersive game, like I had this note for someone I was working with one time where like, you know, if you want like the player, if the player and the character are meant to be synonymous, the player already answered the call to adventure and resisted and did all of the crossing the threshold and everything when they chose to play your game over other people's games. Exactly. Like, you know, that was them answering the call to adventure was booting up your game. So like, just get to the adventure.
They've done their time in the wilderness on the loading screen.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
They've had their temptations there.
Exactly. Yeah. The time when the loading screen was up and they opened up social media instead and they said, no, I really want to play this game. Yeah.
I mean, I think The Drifter is a great example to circle back to, because I think one thing that game did really well is sort of there's clearly a well-defined character with a history and a knowledge of the world that sort of unspools as we go along. And obviously there's other mysteries as well. But in the moment, the player isn't really asked to do anything about any of that. The player is always said, here is a direct and immediate problem that you can grapple with.
Yeah.
And you kind of get the sense that the character has essentially like two people inside him. One of whom is his collected experiences and trauma and grief and mysteries and all of that. And the other is, you know, that feeling when you wake up and it's a day. It's a new day. And your entire life could just be a story that's been downloaded into your brain. You're just here right now. And that's what the player is. They're the fresh-faced little bunny going, I'm going to fix the car. I don't know how. I'm going to fix the car.
I'm going to do
it. That's quite nice in a way, because then that gives the player a really clear role in the psyche of the character that isn't actually fighting against the trauma responses.
Well, and that was always great about, like, you know, to use Big B Wolf as an example again, where it's like, you know, he's a character where he always, you know, you like the player is basically the player's Big B's Jiminy Cricket. You know, he's sort of like he's helping Big B decide, you know, whether or not, you know, what he's going to do. And yeah, and so it's like, I think, you know, Telltale, like, I think was at its best when we did kind of maintain a little bit more of a healthy distance between character and protagonist and this feeling that, you know, you are kind of the, like, it's kind of fulfilling this notion of, you know, like if you're watching a TV show and you're yelling at the screen what you want you want the character to do, you're kind of living in that world.
There was an absolutely terrific text adventure made in, I want to say like 1999, which is called Ramesses. It's obviously very not massively heard of, but it's by a guy called Stephen Bond, in which you play an awkward, anxious teenager, and it consistently does this mechanic of giving you, like, a kid comes and bullies you, and there's some options of things you can say, like, hey, back off, or, you know, come over here and say that, and you choose the option, and the character says, yeah, no, I'm not saying that. And then, yeah, no, I'm not saying. And the only one you can say is, okay, sorry, fine. And it will just whittle down your options until you're left with the one that the character actually can say. And then brilliantly, it kind of takes you to the edge of this lake and you've had this miserable experience, and we kind of all know, because we've all seen the genre, that the kid is going to jump in the water and kill himself, and we're like, oh my god, this is that's how this story's got to end. It's a miserable, depressing teenage suicide type story. So you type jump in the water, and of course the character says, no, I'm not doing that.
That's wonderful. I love that.
And it's brilliant, this character that pushes back. And obviously it's hugely risky to have a character that just says no. But I mean, in a sense, it's also saying, I'm not going to put my lips on that, I suppose.
Right.
So that
exactly
takes us full circle. But
I think what a wonderful example, like you just described, where it's like, you think you're giving him what he wants. You think you're just giving in. You're like, all right, I see where this is going. Fine. Jump in the water. And he's like, no. And then that is suddenly weirdly him disagreeing with you is growth. I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah. That exactly. Itself is the growth.
But we're there at the moment of it happening. Yeah, exactly.
It's the twist. It's the very same twist that we're talking about, because it was established as like, this is the type of ambiguous situation. I don't know which answer I can give. I don't know which answer they're going to push back on. And that very same thing is what's twisted later. I mean, yeah, that does seem very powerful. On your point, Eric, the fact that these protagonists work really, really well, it strikes me that there is perhaps all of us that are trying to come up with these like novel setups and these novel characters, we're doing the work the hardest possible way there could be, right? Like, there's a reason why the majority of human storytelling across all, you know, 200,000 years of our species has been mythological characters that we are borrowing from one another, where you know what they represent, you know what their like central challenges are going to be. Very often they represent specific sins or specific elements of a personality. And you know that that's what that story is going to be about. And you're interested in the different facet of it. That's why we still like to read a Batman story. We kind of know, like, there's not that many more ways take it. But yeah,
I mean, I think one of the things that people tend to forget is that, like, things like marketing are an intentional part of the storytelling experience as well. Like, the storytelling doesn't have to start just when you boot up the game. Like, you know, you think back to, again, like, you know, movies in the 70s, you'd go in and watch the trailer, and the trailer usually expounds for you what the conflict the characters be going through is. And so it's like, again, you sit down, you're like, oh, this guy's being horrible, but I get a pretty good feeling he's going to be great by the end, you know, the end. And so it's like, I think there's this, yeah, like, I think, you know, and I think what you're talking about, these kind of mythological figures, you know, it used to be an oral storytelling. I was reading about kind of like some of these old, some of this old Korean, I don't remember the word for it now, but it was like way, way back. And it would be the sort of plays that would be put on in bars by sort of these traveling troops. And these traveling troops of performers would show up and say, "We're going to tell you a story about so-and-so." And it would be a character that everyone would know. And everyone would go, "Yeah, I love these." And it's like, because it gets so much of these table setting
out of the way
done. And then everyone's like, I know what's going to happen here. Can't wait to see which of these people is going to play the nasty landlord.
Absolutely. And it was a standard structure in the mystery plays that sort of Christian traveling troops around Europe would do. Mm-hmm. And also Chinese opera has like characters that seem very specific to us as a Western audience. It's like the sad auntie and things like that are kind of recurring tropes.
Commedia dell'arte, like, you see this all over the place because it's such an effective trope when you don't have any other rapid distribution system, right? Like, we're living in the weird moment where we have all these like new characters and we have to do all the work to tell the people about it while they've like while we're convincing them to spend time. And by the way, unlike a movie, they don't know how long they're gonna have to devote to this, so they could just watch that movie and be like, oh, it might work, it might not, okay, 2 hours, whatever. Whereas like, they might be like, I'm 40 hours in, I haven't figured out what the twist is yet. Yeah, like, what, you know, our medium, we kind of work against it a bit there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Lovely. Well, I mean, I feel like we've covered a lot of things, but very few of the things I expected to cover, but that's fine.
I hope there's something interesting or useful in here.
I think it's so interesting. That's the thing. I think it's really interesting. And we haven't really done an episode, I'm not sure which order the episodes will come out, but that's really digging into sort of protagonist character, which is just obviously such a huge part of storytelling, but sometimes one that games don't even necessarily touch on at all, bizarrely. So it's been really brilliant to talk to you about that, but I think we should wrap it up there. So I'm going to say thank you very much, Eric.
Thank you
for joining us. It's been absolutely superb. And listeners, please join us again next week when we will have another terrific writer from the Kaleidoscope to talk to us. So thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.
Bye.